Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
3, 2, 1... Ladies and gentlemen, take your seats, have your first drinks.
Please a toast out. To opening up, I talked to former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown about lifting lockdowns, combating vaccine inequality and more pressing issues. Then...
We're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War.
Sacha Baron Cohen transformed from the bumbling Borat to 1960s social activist Abby Hoffman. The Oscar-nominated actor joins us along with director Aaron Sorkin to discuss their riveting historical court drama, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Plus...
I'm deeply concerned about the opportunities in rural America.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack tells our Walter Isaacson how growing up an orphan inspired him to help America's forgotten families. Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Prime Minister Boris Johnson led a special session in the House of Commons today, paying tribute to Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth's husband of more than 70 years, who died on Friday.
Though I suspect, Mr. Speaker, that he might be embarrassed or even faintly exasperated to receive these tributes, he made this country a better place. And for that, he will be remembered with gratitude and with fondness for generations to come.
Now, a funeral will be held on Saturday, a low-key affair by royal standards, in part due to COVID restrictions. Now, while many rules are still in place, England's vaccine rollout has been a success and lockdowns are starting to lift. All shops can reopen today, such as hairdressers and gyms, and outdoor pints at pubs are now allowed. England, along with the United States, are moving quickly towards vaccine-backed herd immunity, but so many other countries are nowhere near achieving that goal. As Britain prepares to host the G7 meeting of the world's most advanced economies in June, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says global mass vaccination must be the highest priority. He says it makes financial sense and it is a moral imperative. And he's going to join us in a moment. But first, Minnesota once again erupts in protest after police fatally shot another black man at a traffic stop. According to the police chief, the officer was attempting to draw her taser, but accidentally pulled her gun and fired it. The community is shaken. The 20-year-old Daunte Wright was shot not far from where former policeman Derek Chauvin is on trial now for the killing of George Floyd. His death really propelled the Black Lives Matter movement, which is defining this current era, just as the 1960s and 70s were defined by a different wave of protest, anti-war activism. The Oscar-nominated film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, tackles this topic, telling the story of a group of Vietnam War protesters charged with conspiracy for allegedly inciting riots at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. It's a riveting historical courtroom drama with a whole host of acclaimed actors, including the man who brought Borat to life, Sacha Baron Cohen. Take a look at this clip from the trailer.
They were chanting that the whole world is watching.
If we leave here without saying anything about why we came in the first place, it'll be heartbreaking.
Last summer, why did you come to the convention?
To end the war.
We're giving them exactly what they want, a stage and an audience.
Yeah, you really think there's going to be a big audience?
Here I am!
This is what revolution looks like, real revolution.
We may have to hurt somebody's feelings.
So I've been talking to Sacha Baron Cohen and writer-director Aaron Sorkin about the way that trial resonates today amid the courtroom effort to find justice for George Floyd and, of course, the incitement and insurgency on Capitol Hill back in January. Sacha Baron Cohen, Aaron Sorkin, welcome to the program. What do you make of the reality in which we live mirroring, to some extent, your film and that era?
You know, I'm not sure if we boomeranged back to 1968, like we were stretching a rubber band, or it's always been there, and somehow, you know, Donald Trump uncovered it. This all started in 2006, almost 15 years ago now, when Steven Spielberg asked me to come over to his house on a Saturday morning. And just to be clear, that's not common. I don't hang out with Steven Spielberg on Saturday mornings. He told me he wanted to make a movie about the Chicago 7, and I said, Chicago 7, that sounds great. Count me in. Chicago 7 will make a great movie. And I left his house, and I called my father and asked my father who the Chicago 7 were. So I was just saying yes to working with Steven Spielberg then. But I did a lot of research. There are a dozen or so good books, some of them written by the defendants. There's a 21,000-page trial transcript. But I always wanted the film to be about today and not 1968. I just never imagined how much about today it would end up being. Just also wanted to mention January 6th attack on the Capitol. It was actually Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and a few others who stood at a microphone and did exactly what the Chicago 7 were on trial for doing, inciting a riot.
I mean, it really is extraordinary. And of course, in a moment, we'll also talk about Borat, because that also has the Rudy Giuliani episode in it.
And it's just I'm excited to talk about Borat.
You will soon. Sacha, you also kind of have a long history with Abbie Hoffman, right? You play Abbie Hoffman in the film. He's the head of the Yippies, the Youth International Movement. And you, though, I think came across him, studied him when you were still at college.
Yes. So 1992, I did my undergraduate thesis about Jews in the Black Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, and Abbie features prominently. And he was one of many students who went down to the South and risked their lives to fight against systemic racism. And what I was looking into was, why were Jews 30 times more likely than American whites to be involved in the Civil Rights Movement? Then that group went on and formed the basis of the anti-Vietnam War movement. So many of the Chicago 7 had actually been down South in the Freedom Rides. And Abbie was somebody who I found fascinating even back then, because he was using humor to undermine the establishment and mock unjust power. So he was inspirational even back then.
We've got several clips from the movie, and I want to play this one, which has, you know, we go between the real Abbie Hoffman and then a clip from the movie. So I'm going to play it.
I think we're being tried with carrying a state of mind across the state border. And it's a very unusual law, and we're the first ones to be tried under it.
Do you know why you're on trial here?
We carried certain ideas across state lines. Not machine guns or drugs or little girls, ideas. When we crossed from New York to New Jersey to Pennsylvania to Ohio to Illinois, we had certain ideas. And for that, we were gassed, beaten, arrested, and put on trial.
How difficult was it for you to emulate and translate and interpret him? I'm really fascinated that Aaron chose a whole bunch of very distinguished British actors to play these iconic Americans.
I mean, it was a real challenge, I have to be honest. Firstly, the accent is difficult, even for most Americans, to play a kind of Boston accent is seen as the trickiest one. He also was very influenced by the comedian Lenny Bruce. And during the trial, he'd go on tour to raise money for the Chicago 7 by doing stand-up, but it was political stand-up, and he was hilarious. So, I mean, what I did was, I tried to do as much research as I could. He was very, very aware of the power of press. You know, he would have been on this show trying to spread his cause, and Aaron brilliantly shows in the script, he wants to demonstrate where the cameras are. And he realized that the whole trial was not to prevent them from being imprisoned. He knew they were going to jail. He knew that it was to convince people at home and make it entertaining enough that people at home would turn against this unjust war. So just did a huge amount of research. The idea was not to emulate him, but to somehow kind of inhabit him. And then I had this incredible script to play with.
Let me play this little clip of Eddie Redmayne playing Tom Hayden. Tom Hayden was less about revolution and more about sort of progressive change. And Abbie Hoffman was more about, you know, major revolutionary change. So we're going to play this clip.
My problem is that for the next 50 years, when people think of progressive politics, they're going to think of you. They're going to think of you and your idiot followers passing out daisies to soldiers and trying to levitate the Pentagon. So they're not going to think of equality or justice. They're not going to think of education or poverty or progress. They're going to think of a bunch of stone-lost, disrespectful, foul-mouthed, lawless losers. And so we'll lose elections.
Well, the political tension between Abbie and Tom, which is really my favorite part of the film, because it's the personal part of the film. It's the story of these two guys who they're on the same side. They plainly can't stand each other, and they each think that the other is doing harm to the cause. And to me, it's very much a reflection of what you see in the Democratic Party today, of the tension between the left and the further left. People who think change needs to be incremental, and people who are tired of incremental change and want some kind of revolution.
Sacha Baron Cohen, much has been written about you, but I think it's interesting that not only do people consider you obviously a brilliant satirist, comedian, but also a political and social activist. And I've heard you talk about not just this film, but also Borat, in which you had an agenda, you had a political agenda, certainly regarding Donald Trump and the 4 years of that administration.
I don't perceive myself as having a role. I just felt compelled to do something. So I was particularly worried and angered by Trump's presidency. I was terrified about what would happen to America if Trump won again. And so I did three things. One, I ensured that I could make Chicago 7 and I stopped Borat to do it. Two, I decided to make Borat to incentivize and urge any fans of mine to go out and vote. It ended with a simple message, which was now vote. And that's why Borat was designed to infiltrate the Trump regime. And the third thing I did was I came out as myself and spoke about the danger of social media. And the reason I did that was I believe deeply that if social media didn't change prior to the election, that its inherent bias towards misinformation and lies and conspiracies would help Trump to win. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to be a bystander. I was inspired by the likes of Abbie Hoffman. And I felt those were the three things I could do.
You said Borat was to protect the American democracy from Donald Trump. You went to some pretty extraordinary lengths and took some pretty extraordinary risks. I mean, obviously the end where, you know, the young actress was portrayed as your daughter, and she went in to interview Rudy Giuliani. I mean, of course, everybody knows about that scene. It's viral. Everybody knows. But just how scary was it for you and for her? And what kind of security measures did you have to take?
Well, yes. I mean, we had been told that he would come with police protection, and he came with a cop. And we also knew that the cop would check the room for anyone who was there. And so we built a hideaway that I stayed inside of for about an hour and a half. It was a little bit wider than me and about 6'5" high. And I hid in there while the guy was casing the room. And then when we left, well, the interview ended And then the policeman told us to stay in the room, myself and Maria, and that we weren't allowed to leave the room. And I was playing Borat, obviously. Borat doesn't know what a chair is. What does this machine with four legs? And suddenly the cop was saying, stay in the room until the rest of the police arrive. I was like, you have no right to, this is my property. You must leave my property. Suddenly Borat was an expert on New York law. And so the guy, this is false imprisonment. I warn you, my lawyers will be just... And we basically ran out of the hotel to a getaway vehicle. Giuliani then accused us of a federal crime and therefore got the room searched, which is hugely improper because, you know, it's essentially, you know, our property because we bought the paid for the room. And I was advised, and myself and Maria were advised to leave the state in a rush because we had hired a cop to protect us. He had immediately told Giuliani's cop where I was staying, the Airbnb I was staying, and the crew hotel. And then I was advised by a lawyer to leave the state immediately. And I was frantically calling friends. Hi, how are you? I haven't spoken to you in a few years. Could I stay at yours? Sure, when? How about in 20 minutes? And one of them said yes. And I drove out to Connecticut and stayed at his house. Had a lovely time for a couple of days. And the police impounded the equipment.
And just, I mean, obviously Maria, I mean, you're not American either, but she's definitely not American and a very young actress. Were you concerned about her safety? Did you sort of game plan that?
Yes. I assured her as a producer that I would look after her. So we had her security team and we, you know, went through the escape route and everything. And, you know, obviously, if I had not intervened, the interview might have ended up in a rather sordid place. And I guaranteed her that I would not let that happen. So also in the rest of the movie, I tried to ensure that she was not there for some of the more dangerous scenes, or she was not there in a position where she could get hurt.
Aaron, I mean, you've been sort of giggling as this story is being recounted, but I want to ask you, as an American director, writer, artist, Sacha Baron Cohen stands out for really pushing the limits and really, you know, I think it's very courageous. You know, many people might have their own views about it, but, you know, the Ali G persona, Who is America, all the people who've had to, you know, quit their jobs or be turfed out because of how they've revealed themselves.
Well, there's no doubt that Sasha is doing that. And by the way, I think he's more than a little courageous. I don't think people don't realize that Sasha regularly puts himself in danger and would never, by the way, put anyone else in danger. But when he walks into CPAC or the Giuliani scene, he's putting himself in either legal or physical danger.
Sasha, do you think you will do another Borat? Is there a time when you think, well, I've done that or I can't do that anymore?
I plan to not do it again. I think that Borat was a near impossible movie to make because for the pure fact that at its basis, if word had got out that I was making Borat, it would have been impossible to make because we're relying on real people not knowing who I am.
Borat! What do you say? No, it's not me.
I think also the movie ended up being a lot more dangerous than I expected. And I think, quite frankly, you can prepare, but you rely on a lot of luck. And there was a gun rights rally that I was at where I was chased off stage. Somebody reached for his pistol, and I was lucky enough that a bodyguard grabbed his arm and stopped the guy doing whatever he was intending to do. I think it's too dangerous to do anymore. And again, I brought the gray suit out of the wardrobe for the purpose of trying to convince a few fans to vote against Trump. So that purpose is not there anymore. And no, I don't want to take the risk anymore.
Right.
If, if I can just jump in, yes. And I promise you, I do not own stock in Sacha Baron Cohen. But Sacha was making Borat before and after Chicago 7. He stopped making Borat to do Chicago 7, promising the they needed to get the film out before the election, promising the producers that we'll still be able to make it if we just take these 8 weeks and stop. The producers were saying, no, you'll never be able to make it. He swore that they could. We wrapped and COVID almost immediately began. So no one anticipated he was going to run into that. But as difficult as it must have been to make Borat the first time, imagine the skill it takes to make it the second time when everyone knows who Borat is and can see him coming.
It is remarkable. And just final word then, Aaron, to your film. What do you hope the legacy of the trial of the Chicago 7 will be? Why did you want to do it?
Before anything else, I just want it to be a movie that people like watching, a courtroom drama that people like watching. But beyond that, I hope it's a Valentine to protest. One of the things it took so many years to make the movie, but the thing that finally got it made, I hate giving credit to Donald Trump for anything, but he's what greenlit the movie. Because at his rallies, there'd be protesters and he'd start getting nostalgic about the old days when we carried that guy out of here on a stretcher and I'd like to punch him in the face and beat the crap out of him, I'll pay your legal bills. Everybody thought that athletes kneeling during the national anthem made them un-American, unpatriotic. So the Chicago 7, they were called unpatriotic, un-American, anti-American, overly educated, pansies. They were anything but weak. They risked their lives. They risked 10 years in federal prison. And it's widely accepted today that they hastened the end of a war. Stack that up against congressmen and senators who aren't willing to risk having a primary opponent and decide who the patriots are.
It is remarkable. And I would say very seriously that the 4 years of the Trump presidency really did revive protest. And I think in an amazing way on every single level. So Aaron Sorkin, Sacha Baron Cohen, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And both those films have been rewarded with so many nominations and prizes during this awards season. Of course, Oscars are up next. Now, just a note, Rudy Giuliani says the Borat video, of course, is a complete fabrication, and he claims he was never inappropriate. And today is also the 32nd anniversary of the death of Abbie Hoffman, the character Sacha Baron Cohen was playing. He had suffered from bipolar disorder, and he died by suicide in 1989. He was just 52 years old. Now we return to our top story about COVID and the need for a global response to this with the former British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. Welcome to the program. You have been very clear. You've written op-eds, columns about what you think absolutely needs to be done and what should be the highest priority. You've talked about countries perhaps having to put 30, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, $30 billion a year into this effort for the foreseeable future. What has to happen, do you think?
Well, that's a small price to pay because nobody is safe anywhere until everybody is safe everywhere. And you know, we've got 70% of adults vaccinated in the United Kingdom, but only 1% of adults in sub-Saharan Africa. And as long as the rest of the world is not vaccinated, whether it's 2022 or 2023 before they are, then the disease will continue to spread, it will mutate, there will be new variants, and of course it threatens both lives and livelihoods in every country of the world. So it's not a choice between vaccinating at home and vaccinating around the world. We've got to do both. Now the price, $30 billion a year, very small price to pay. It's far less than what has been lost in output. It's far smaller than what we had to do in 2009 when we had a trillion stimulus at the G20. President Biden's got a $2 trillion stimulus in America. $30 billion could be paid by America itself, but I'm suggesting that we burden share right around the world. And of course, the richest countries, the G7, should pay the lion's share, about 60% of the cost that needs to be met.
How would you make this happen if you were prime minister? You mentioned the financial crisis. You were prime minister then. You hosted G7s and other G meetings. And this crisis, COVID, has been marked by its complete lack of global coordination. It's like each person for themselves, each country for themselves, each state for themselves. What would you say to your fellow leaders in June at the G7 to make this happen?
Yeah, last year, we wasted the chance to cooperate. We didn't cooperate on exchanging information, on getting the vaccine out. Of course, we didn't cooperate on equipment and ventilators. This year, we've got a real chance. President Biden has said he wants to contribute. The Europeans, I think, realize that they've got to be part of a collective effort. And then China, Russia, the other countries should come in. I think the starting point is the G7 meeting. June the 13th, United Kingdom, Boris Johnson chairing. Now, if he can do what we tried to do in 2009 and bring together the major countries, and instead of saying we're going to have a whip round to raise money, which is what has happened in the past and in the last few months, what you say is, look, here's a fair system of burden sharing. It's based on what you contribute to the United Nations peacekeeping. It's similar to what was done when we eradicated smallpox in the 1960s, when there was a levy on World Health Organization members. So bring people together. America play roughly 25%, Europe roughly 25%, G7, 60%, G20 as a whole, 85 to 90%, the oil states, Scandinavia, then you've got some other countries who would be prepared to contribute. And then you can say to the poorer countries, we can get on with this vaccination program. We solved the problem of discovery with brilliant science. We'll solve the problem of logistics with manufacturing. We've got to now solve the problem of finance.
Mm-hmm. Gordon Brown, you know, obviously we've said that Britain has done a great job with the vaccine rollout. But of course, there's all these complaints about vaccine nationalism and now some countries are stopping exports. It's just a bit of a mess in terms of the big picture. The foreign minister of...
Well, that's a lack of coordination as well.
Well, exactly. But I just want to ask you to address this because the Kenyan foreign ministry accused the UK of, quote, vaccine apartheid. That is really strong. He said vaccine producing countries around the world have begun practicing a form of vaccine nationalism, possessiveness and discrimination, coupled with a vaccine hoarding attitude that can only be described as a form of vaccine apartheid. And let me also just play the Secretary General of the WHO, who believes in what you're saying, and then we can discuss.
There remains a shocking imbalance in the global distribution of vaccines. More than 700 million vaccine doses have been administered globally, but over 87% have gone to high-income or upper-middle-income countries, while low-income countries have received just 0.2%. On average, in high-income countries, almost one in four people has received a vaccine. In low-income countries, it's one in more than 500.
So I want to ask you because, you know, we have seen Africa, which does not seem to have exploded in a catastrophe that people had predicted, given its much less robust public health system. We don't really know the full extent of what's happening in Russia. It's claimed that the cases and the deaths are much higher than are being reported. But we do know what's happening in India, and that is it's kind of a meltdown right now. They're quite good, you know, coping at the beginning has morphed into a disaster. And they're saying, experts, I'm sure you agree, that what happens in India, you know, is going to sort of dominate the global COVID response and the reality. So again, what do we need to be looking for in that part of the world as well, or to help that part of the world?
Yes, you're absolutely right. What's missing is coordination of the production of the vaccine. We solved the problem, as I said, of discovery, brilliant science, but now we've got to ramp up production in every part of the world. Now, that could mean transferring technology, licensing agreements, the patent being temporarily waived, and that's something that has been discussed in the World Health Organization. But one way or another, we've got to ramp up the supply. And I think that could be done very quickly because there are so many vaccines now, and at the same time, potential producers are available. That's a logistics problem. then you've got to get to the finance. And what Africa is complaining about is that they're not going to get a supply of vaccine for a long time. I think 70,000 people only have been fully vaccinated in sub-Saharan Africa. And that compares with, what, 30 million in Britain already. And so there's a justifiable complaint that they are going to be treated as second-class citizens in that, and that cannot be justified. It's not their fault that the vaccine, it's not their fault that the virus is there. It's not their fault that they are not initially the producers of the vaccine, but we've got to get the vaccine to them as quickly as possible. And I tell you, from my experience of world meetings, this is a deliverable at the June the 13th G7. It needs the countries to get round the table to say, we've got to have a burden-sharing agreement. Then I can suggest a number of financing mechanisms so you front-load the vaccines so they get to people quickly and you pay over a period of time. It all can be done if the governments could get their act together and work together.
Let me ask you, because you're there in Scotland, this beautiful background, and, you know, I don't just bring it up as a landscape issue, but very soon there's going to be another election in May for the local elections. And it's considered that Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP, will win very handily again. And then they will want to, you know, with undue delay, put the referendum for independence back on the table. We're also seeing in Northern Ireland the first protests in many, many years, partly about COVID lockdown, but partly about Brexit and the rules that they believe are threatening their way of life. As a former Prime Minister who was there at the Good Friday Agreement, who persuaded, I think, Scotland not to go for independence last time around, are you concerned that the union could be fragmenting now?
I think we've got a British problem. I think you might define it as a Scottish problem and then a Northern Ireland problem, and then we might look at whether there's a Welsh problem and an English regional problem. I think there is a British problem that people feel that the government at the centre is out of touch, not listening, not consulting. And that's a feeling in Scotland. It's also a feeling in Northern Ireland. It's a feeling in Wales. And if you go to Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, go north in England, it's also a feeling there. So there are very specific things in Scotland, which we can talk about, very, very specific things in Northern Ireland about the border between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. But there is a general sense that this multinational state has got to reform and cannot be as centralised, cannot be the unitary state where the man in Whitehall is said to know best. It's got to change. It's got to reform. And I think that's where the pressure is going to come after these May elections.
It's going to be really interesting because, you know, some people during the heat of Brexit said we'd rather see the union collapse than not have our Brexit and our divorce from Europe and the EU. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Can I ask you on a wider background? You've noticed probably this heightened tension between not just the United States and Europe and Iran over the nuclear agreement, but Israel. And it's been reported in the Israeli press and in the US press that there seems to be a covert shipping war between the two countries, Israel and Iran. And now it appears that Israel may have had something to do with a malfunction or an explosion at the Natanz nuclear station in Iran. When you look at all that, how worried are you about yet another war, accidentally or not, in the Middle East?
I think President Biden's doing the right thing. I think if negotiations can start, I think they'll get a settlement. I think there's too much at stake for both America and Iran for this to continue forever. And I do think that what we're debating is how we get this agreement. So Iran has got to stop enriching uranium and got to get back to where it was as far as is possible. America has got to insist that the sanctions remain until Iran makes these steps. And of course, there is issues about Iran's support for regional terrorism, its own human rights record itself, and all these things are going to be part of how the sanctions are withdrawn so that Iran comes back into the agreement that we had in 2015. Now, it may be that President Biden will insist that Iran takes steps to deal with regional terrorism as part of that, but it would be roughly similar, I think, to the deal of 2015. And I do think that President Biden, by keeping his nerve, by being calm and cool about this, Antony Blinken, of course, did the original deal with President Obama. I think they've got the right negotiators in place to get a deal. And I would say that we're dealing with the skirmishes that are going to happen and bound to happen before we eventually get a new deal.
So let me end by asking you, as Prime Minister, you had many audiences with the Queen, obviously, and Prince Philip has died. He was her husband for, I think, nearly 74 years and partner in crime, if I can put it that way. He was her, as she said, my strength and my stay. What to you is the impression you had of him, of them together, and what they brought to this country?
Well, if you met the Queen in recent years, as I did, and you asked her about the welfare of Prince Philip, you could see her face light up. I mean, such was the strength of the bond between the two, such was the strength of that relationship, that you can see when people asked about Prince Philip, she was very happy indeed that people felt that for him as well as for her. And, you know, I think he will go down as someone who was a great public servant, because I grew up with the Peace Corps that John Kennedy created in the 1960s. But Prince Philip had created in 1955 the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme. And that's a community service scheme, public service. It's now in 140 countries. There are 400,000 young people in Africa on that scheme at the very moment. There are millions of young people, including in my family, who have benefited from the public service and the community work that was encouraged by the Duke of Edinburgh scheme. So I think he's made a huge contribution to two or three generations of young people growing up with this idea that they should be committed to public service and community action. And the Peace Corps in the States was so important. I think the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme has been really important to Britain.
Mm. And I can't let you go without asking you about a bit of a tawdry, I guess, crisis that's happening here about lobbying and the revolving door. You know, David Cameron basically is admitted to perhaps have made acting within the rules, but perhaps of making poor judgment by, you know, being so close to this businessman. What do you think needs to happen to protect the integrity of government and government dealings while an office holder is in public office?
Yeah, I don't know all the details of David Cameron's events, but I do know that there should be principles governing government. The first is that public service should not be the platform for private gain. The second is that former ministers should not be lobbying for commercial contracts. And if you have to put a time limit, put a time limit on it, but I don't think it's right in the first place. And thirdly, ministers themselves, people in government, should not be entertaining that sort of lobbying from people, whether they're former colleagues or not.
It sounds simple enough. Gordon Brown, thank you so much indeed for joining us. We turn now to the longest-serving cabinet member in the Obama administration, Tom Vilsack. Having served 8 years as Agriculture Secretary under the former president, Vilsack has now returned to the same position for the new Biden administration. And here he is speaking with our Walter Isaacson about the assistance his department has provided to farmers throughout the pandemic, as well as his plans for reform.
Thank you, Christiane, and Secretary Tom Vilsack. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Your Agriculture Department budget, 70% of it goes to nutrition assistance, things like SNAP and what we called food stamps. Tell me how, during the pandemic, that's been affected and what you're doing now.
Well, obviously, the pivot from food service to food assistance wasn't as smooth as any of us would have liked. But the reality is there were a lot of people in need. And so first and foremost, we saw an increase in the need for SNAP, increased enrollments. Secondly, we saw the need for an increase in the amount of SNAP, and a 15% increase for a family of four means about $102 more coming into the family budget every month for the next several months. You know, what's interesting about that is it not only helps that family buy more food, but it also keeps people employed. That SNAP increase really supports tens of thousands of jobs, if you think about it. Folks have to process, package, transport, and every farmer benefits from that as well. Roughly 14 to 15 cents of every food dollar spent at the grocery store ends up in a farmer's pocket. So the SNAP program is an incredible program. It's an anti-poverty program, but it's also it supports the economy during very difficult times. But we complemented SNAP with an additional program called the Pandemic EBT, recognizing, as you know, many moms and dads send their children off to school. They may get school breakfast, they may get school lunch, but when schools are shut down, that lunch and breakfast then becomes, again, the family's responsibility. So we are providing additional support for families who find themselves with children at home because schools are shut down with our Pandemic EBT program. So a lot of ways in which we're trying to help families get through this very difficult time.
Well, the nutrition safety net affects young children often and the elderly. But are you doing things now for like homeless, you know, younger people or people who may have been affected by this pandemic that you don't naturally serve?
Well, there's been an expanded effort in two phases in response to that question. First, the additional resources for those youths who are living in shelters, as you say, homeless folks who are, find themselves, they may be teenagers, they may be in their early 20s, finding themselves without a job, without a home. We're providing additional financial resources and additional food assistance for the homeless shelters. We're also taking a look at ways in which we can make the availability of food assistance more convenient by providing now well over 1.5 million families in the United States are benefiting from online purchases as opposed to having to go to the grocery store. And I think we're going to learn from this pandemic a number of strategies potentially to make benefits not only more meaningful, but also to modernize the system so that people can utilize their benefits in the most convenient way possible.
You've had an interesting childhood. As a biographer, I'm always looking for clues of what drives people. And it was a challenge. You were an orphan, a family that had addiction problems. Tell me about that and how that helped shape your approach.
Well, I think my mom probably was the greatest influence in my life prior to meeting my wife, Christy. She battled with addiction, both alcohol and prescription drug addiction, and she overcame that addiction. Attempted suicide a couple of times. Was violent at times. Not an easy period of time. My parents separated for a period for a while. I lived with my dad. It was a hard time. But my mom basically taught me never to give up on something I truly believed in. She didn't give up on herself, and she eventually, with a lot of faith and a lot of work, basically gained her sobriety. And in doing so, I think taught myself and my sister an incredibly important, valuable life lesson, never to give up, never to give up on things that you care deeply about. And that stood me in good stead when I ran for governor and I was 20 points behind with a couple weeks to go. Pretty easy to give up in a race like that. I didn't. As a result, I ended up winning and had not only a great experience as being governor, but now experience as being Secretary of Agriculture, not once, but twice.
And yes, Secretary of Agriculture during the President Obama's tenure, you also took on the opioid crisis. Why did you do that? And how focused were you on the rural areas, which is your specialty?
Well, I did it in large part because of my mom and recognizing the challenge that overcoming addiction is. And I did it because I'm deeply concerned about the opportunities in rural America. As I think Bill Clinton once said, if your tomorrow is not brighter than your today, you can kind of understand why people turn to drugs and why they can become potentially addicted. And certainly opioids, a very serious, problem in rural areas. Serious for multiple reasons. One, because the economy wasn't as strong. So those tomorrows weren't as bright, weren't going to be as brighter than the today. Two, because there were a lack of resources available to people that wanted to get help. And three, if you live in a small town, the stigma of addiction can sometimes make it more difficult for you to have success in the future. So it was important, I think, for the Obama administration to begin the process of educating people that this is a disease. It's not a character flaw. That's another lesson I learned from my mom. It's not a character flaw. It's not like, well, if you just tough it out, you can figure this out.
The American farm families have been struggling, and some in particular, suicide rates, opioid. How do you deal, especially as a Democrat, with rural Americans who think the system has left them behind, tend to take it out on the Democratic Party? How are you reconnecting with farm families and rural families in America?
Well, first and foremost, it's about respect and acknowledging what people in rural America do for the rest of us. If you think about this, These folks provide the most of the food that we rely on. A good deal of the water that we drink is directly connected to the work that they do on the land. They are the producers of most of the renewable energy that we are currently consuming and want to consume more of. They are the holders and protectors of most of the iconic landscapes in this country. And they are people that send their sons and daughters into the military in disproportionate numbers. There's a value system in rural America that I think is important to the country, and it's a value system that strongly believes in community and responsibility of giving something back. Young people learn that you can't keep taking from the land. You have to replenish it. Number two, also appreciate the emotional stress that folks who live in rural communities have seen as they've watched their community shrink over time, as they've watched their children and grandchildren leave for better opportunities someplace else. It's an emotional strain. And so I think it's incumbent on the Department of Agriculture and incumbent on the Secretary of Agriculture to do everything he or she can do to create economic opportunity, to rebuild, to revitalize, to transform those rural communities, and to let people know that that's what you are focused on every single day. And I think there's an enormous opportunity, especially with climate. I think climate, as difficult, as challenging as it's going to be to have a changing climate and all the consequences of that, I think it also opens up the opportunity to simply redefine and transform the entire American economy, particularly in rural places.
Yet the Democratic Party has been slammed in rural America, and that's been the great new divide in our country between rural and urban. What's the problem that the Democratic Party has? Are they not showing that respect you just talked about?
You can't beat something with nothing. And for far too long, the Democratic Party has failed to provide an alternative narrative to folks who live in rural communities. The narrative that Republicans provide is a simple one: less government, less taxes. And if you're just hanging on, if you're just trying to figure out how to make the payroll, or just trying to figure out how to make ends meet from week to week, hanging on sounds pretty good. And less government interference and less taxes sounds really, really good. If there's a competing narrative about a changing economy that creates new revenue streams for farmers, that allows you to say to your sons and daughters that there's real opportunity for you to keep the farm and to expand the farming operation, if you can say to folks, there's manufacturing coming back to rural communities, transforming agricultural waste into a variety of new bio-based products and materials, moving us away from a fossil fuel, climate-challenging environment, now all of a sudden you've got a competing narrative. And you have a way in which you can essentially make the case your life can be better if you are embracing the policies that we are advocating. And I think we're now beginning to learn about that. So first of all, you have to have something. Secondly, you got to be there. You got to be present. You got to go out and you got to speak to people. And you got to sometimes listen to the harsh reality that you sometimes get when you do listen to folks in rural communities, how upset that they might be. And then finally, it is about the respect that when you go and listen, that you respect the contribution that folks have made, that you don't demean them and you don't see them as something less.
You served for a full 8 years in the Obama administration as Secretary of Agriculture, which is somewhat unusual to make it that long in the cabinet. And then when President Biden came in, there were a lot of people who wanted to be agriculture secretary, and yet they bring you back for another term. Why were they pushing to have you come back? And what did you feel you still had to do or you didn't do the last time around that made you finally say yes?
I think during the course of the campaign, I convinced then Vice President Biden that there was enormous opportunity on the climate side in rural places. And I think because of that, you saw the passion with which I delivered that message. He wanted me to give me the opportunity to make good on what I was suggesting could happen. And I think in terms of things that I wanted to do or things that were left undone, the reality is this job is never done. There are always things that need to be done or things that need to be done better or things that need to be done deeper. And one of the things that we needed to do was to continue the work that we started in the Obama administration of dealing with the discrimination, the history of discrimination at the Department of Agriculture for socially disadvantaged producers. And there was an opportunity for us to dig deeper, for us to root out systemic barriers that exist in the department to provide a more equitable and fair department and to sort of change the reputation of the department among minority producers. And that was a big challenge and a big opportunity.
So you're focusing, among other things, on racial equity as part of this, as part of your tenure now. Explain how that's going to work, and especially the loan forgiveness program that was just passed.
I think in the Obama administration, the focus was on trying to compensate people for specific acts of discrimination that may have occurred 20 or 30 years ago. And that was done with the settlement of class action cases. But what we didn't do and what needs to be done is basically to take a look at, as I said, the systemic barriers that exist in the programs today and to address the cumulative effect of the discrimination that occurred. When you were discriminated against, it meant that you didn't get a loan or that you got a loan late or you weren't able to put your crop in the ground at exactly the same time your neighbor put their crop in the ground. Your productivity was less. Because your productivity was less, you didn't have the opportunity to buy that new piece of equipment or expand your farming operation when land became available. And over time, your operation remained static. Your neighbor's operation continued to grow. Now you've got USDA programs that essentially provide help and assistance based on production, based on size. If you're small and you don't have as much production, you don't get as much help. Let me give you an example. In the recent COVID payments to farmers, roughly 25% of the farmers receiving those payments self-identified as white, African-American, Native American, et cetera. Of that self-identified population, Black farmers received $20 million of assistance and help. White farmers received between $5 and $6 billion in help. So you essentially have a gap between socially disadvantaged producers and those who aren't socially disadvantaged, those who couldn't take full advantage of the programs at USDA and those that do take full advantage of the programs. So the question is, how do you address that gap so that you keep people on the land and you can encourage more farmers? And what we've essentially been able to do with the debt relief program is take a first step towards allowing folks to stay on the land. And now the next step as part of the American Rescue Plan is to begin creating ways in which land access, market access, can be improved, technical assistance can be provided. So over time, the gap that exists because of discrimination that may have taken place long ago for socially disadvantaged producers can be reduced.
Is it hard to explain that to a white farmer who needs debt relief, that the debt relief is going only to the socially disadvantaged farmers, and particularly you're giving debt relief to Black farmers that may be neighbors of white farmers who are struggling?
Well, it may be difficult, but I think when you explain and understand that in the COVID relief package, for example, Black farmers received $20 million when white farmers received $5 to $6 billion, people understand and appreciate that they've had the full benefit and the full advantage of all of these programs for an extended period of time and their neighbor has not. So to the extent that they may feel that this isn't fair, now they might be able to understand how that African-American farmer may have felt for 20 or 30 years. And I think at the end of the day, all of us, all the farmers, white, Black, whatever, I honestly want more people on the land. We want people to farm. We want diversity within agriculture, both in terms of who's farming, but in terms of the size of operations and the method of operation. Diversity is an incredibly important aspect of a healthy agricultural economy.
To what extent is climate change affected by the agriculture sector, and what are you going to be doing about that?
U.S. agriculture is roughly 9% of our overall U.S. emissions. Globally, it's somewhere between 14 to 15%. So in a sense, U.S. agriculture is doing a little bit better than international agriculture generally. There are many things we can do and will be doing. First and foremost, we'll be supporting climate-smart agricultural practices, cover crops, no-till, rotational grazing with our conventional conservation programs and renewing and upping our investment in those climate-smart agricultural practices. Two, we're going to obviously focus on methane and methane reduction. There are feed additives that can reduce methane. There are ways in which methane can be captured from animal livestock and converted into energy and fuel. That's important because we want to maintain the ability to produce animal protein. If we're going to feed a hungry world and ever-increasing world population, animal protein has to be part of the equation. But to do that, we need to do it in a sustainably effective way. We need to also convert agricultural waste into a variety of different new materials that are bio-based. It will create manufacturing jobs in rural places. It will also provide, I think, an opportunity for us to improve water quality because we won't be over-applying that manure on land that doesn't need it. It will be enable us to produce a series of bio-based agricultural products that will create new revenue streams for farmers and reduce emissions. And over a period of time, we will get to President Biden's goal of a net zero emission U.S. agriculture. And I think we'll see early wins in this effort in terms of his administration as we look at ways in which we can incent and encourage more carbon sequestration on the land that that farmers and ranchers have. If we're going to get serious about climate, we got to get serious about carbon sequestration in rural areas. 72% of the land mass in the U.S. is in rural places. We need to utilize that resource to absorb carbon and to improve the soil health at the same time.
Secretary Tom Vilsack, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Of vital existential importance, as we know. And finally tonight, we mark two notable firsts in sports this weekend. In the UK, Rachel Blackmore became the first ever female jockey to win the Grand National. It's the world's most famous and most demanding horse race. And she was exhilarated after her horse, Minella Times, secured their place in history.
I don't feel male, female right now. I don't even feel human. This is just unbelievable.
Superhuman, maybe. You might remember that the Grand National was romanticized in the famous 1944 Elizabeth Taylor film National Velvet. And then in another momentous first, Japanese professional golfer Hideki Matsuyama became the first Asian-born man to win the Masters in Augusta, Georgia.
It's thrilling to think that there are a lot of youngsters in Japan watching today. Hopefully in 5-10 years, when they get a little older, and hopefully some of them will be competing on the world stage.
And we look forward to watching that. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching CNN, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.